disgusted the man, which caused Schwetz to silently ask himself why the fool had let a man he didn't trust handle such a large sum of money. After that, Ivanov, whose job in nature was to be paranoid, spewed out no fewer than a dozen conspiracy theories in as many minutes. He was convinced that Dorfman had gotten drunk and whispered secrets in the wrong person's ear, that this person had then decided to bump Dorfman off and take the money for himself. But then again, there were supposed to have been safeguards in place, so the criminals had to have had a certain level of sophistication. Ivanov had a long list of enemies that he ran through. There was a Cuban general he'd screwed over in an information swap 5 years earlier. How that man could possibly fit into this scenario was beyond Schwetz, but he'd asked for the list of possible suspects, so he simply listened and let Ivanov purge the information from his vodka-soaked brain. There was a German industrialist whom he'd fleeced a year earlier, a Spanish tycoon as well, and then there were a host of Jews and Bolsheviks who had been out to get him for years. None of it appeared to be useful, but then again, maybe it was. Schwetz took the information and boarded a Lufthansa flight to Hamburg. Before leaving, he'd called their man at the consulate and told him to work his contacts with the local police and get him a copy of the crime scene report. When he arrived at 5:36 that evening, Pyotr Sergeyevich was waiting for him, the report in hand. Schwetz had met Pyotr briefly a few years earlier. After a polite exchange, Schwetz told him to drive him to the bank. He sat in the passenger seat and read the report. Herr Dorfman had been stabbed in the thigh and shot once in the head. His wife was found bound and gagged and locked in the basement. She reported two men wearing masks entering the house at approximately 10 in the evening. She did not hear them speak and could not give police a description other than the fact that they were roughly the same size. The dogs, strangely enough, were unharmed. One was locked in the basement with the wife, and the other was found wandering around the first floor. At some point, the latter dog stepped in the pool of blood, by Dorfman said, and then tracked it around the first floor. There was no sign of forced entry, and none of the neighbors had seen a thing. Schwetz found it interesting that the wife and dogs were unharmed. That more than likely ruled out the vying factions in Moscow, although if Schwetz were advising them, he would have tried just this thing to throw off a man like Ivanov. Whoever they were dealing with was very professional. Schwetz finished the report, closed it, and decided it was nearly useless. Anything was possible. Dorfman could have told someone about the money, and that someone could have gotten the idea in his head to steal it. $26 million could do that to certain people. Schwetz had thought about it himself. He had the skill set to make it work. It would have been so much easier if Dorfman had stolen the money and tried to disappear. They would have tracked him down. They always did. The fools habitually ran off to some beachside resort where they naively thought they would blend in with the locals and tourists. They reached the bank shortly after 6:30, and Schwetz weighed the benefits of having Sergeyevich accompany him into the building. He decided against it. There was no need for muscle. At least, not yet, he hoped. And besides, the fewer who knew about Ivanov's vulnerable position, the better. The bank was typical, tall, covered in glass, and imposing, all meant to give the impression of stability and security. It was one of many things that Schwetz was counting on. The armed guard who tried to stop him in the lobby told him the bank was closed, but Schwetz assured him that he did not wish to make a financial transaction. He was tempted to add that that was, of course, unless the guard could somehow refund the $26 million that had been stolen from Schwetz's employer and associates, but Schwetz was fairly certain that this man was incapable of making that happen, so he instead asked to see the head of security. When the security guard hesitated, Schwetz said, "Of course this has something to do with Herr Dorfman's death." That changed things significantly, and in less than a minute Schwetz had been escorted to the top floor, where he came face to face with another, much older security guard, same white shirt with black epaulets and black pants. Schwetz flashed his SVR credentials and told the man secrecy was of the utmost importance. He was then told that the bank president was extremely busy. "No doubt meeting with the board of directors." The uncomfortable look on the man's face gave him the answer he was looking for. "I will wait no more than 2 minutes. Tell him now, and tell him that it involves Herr Dorfman. There are some very influential people in Russia who require some immediate answers." Schwetz sent the man off to deliver the message. Less than a minute later, the guard came back down the hall with a well-dressed man who looked as if he had been through a difficult day. The guard stood awkwardly nearby, while the bank president said, "I am Herr König. How may I help you?"
"I am Nikolai Schwetz. I am with the Russian government."
He again flashed his gilded badge, and then, nodding toward the receptionist, said, "Is there a place where we can have a word in private?"
"Yes," the banker offered, nodding enthusiastically. "Please follow me."
Schwetz was disappointed when they ducked into a glass-walled conference room instead of the man's office. There was nothing to learn from this bland space, no photos of loved ones, not a single hint of personal information. He would have to ask Sergeyevich to look into the man's life for some leverage. König remained standing, obviously impatient to get back to the board.
"What is it you wish to discuss?"
"I understand," Schwetz said, "that Herr Dorfman had a very unfortunate evening last night."
The man nervously cleared his throat.
"The police have advised me not to discuss matters surrounding the murder of Herr Dorfman."
"Would you like me to inform the police that $26 million of Mother Russia's money went missing this morning, or would you like me to go straight to the press with that announcement?"
Schwetz was well aware of his lie, but he could hardly tell the man the money belonged to various terrorist groups and the head of the SVR's feared Directorate S. The banker's gray pallor deepened, and he steadied himself against the back of a nearby chair while he mouthed the number.
"I do not wish to go to either the police or the press, but that is up to you, Herr König."
"What would you like to know?"
"How much money is missing?"
"Counting your 26 million?
47.
"But none of the money was actually in our bank," König said defensively. "In fact, we are trying to sort out what Hans has been up to for all these years."
"What do you mean the money was not in your bank?"
"The deposits were all in Swiss banks or offshore accounts in the Caribbean and Far East."
"But Herr Dorfman managed the accounts in his official capacity as a vice president of this bank."
König raised a cautionary finger.
"We are not sure on that point. So far we have found no official records of any of these accounts in our system."
Schwetz wasn't so sure he believed the man.
"Up until a minute ago, you were thinking your exposure was roughly 20 million. It has now more than doubled. What makes you think it won't double again before tomorrow?"
"I disagree with your use of the phrase, your exposure. As best we can tell, Herr Dorfman was in no way acting as an officer of this bank while he managed these various accounts."
"Herr König," Schwetz said with a sad laugh, "you and I both know that will not stand up. Those deposits may not have sat in your vault, but you had an officer of this bank who was managing on a daily basis a minimum of 47 million and quite possibly more. This bank earned fees off that money, but—"
"Please, let me finish, Herr König. I am not here to assign guilt. I am here to catch whoever took this money so we can get it back to its rightful owners."
Probably for the first time since mid-morning, a touch of color returned to König's face. As there always is in these situations, a financial forensic investigation is underway.
"How long will it take to complete?"
"It could take some time."
"Please be honest with me. I am going to head back to Moscow tomorrow, and the men I work for, they are not nice. They could never have a conversation like this. They would much prefer to strap you to a chair and attach things to your testicles. So I suggest you tell me what you know."
Switching to a friendly tone, he added,
"Then I can go back to them and tell them you are a reasonable man. Someone we can trust."
König struggled with what he was about to say and then blurted it out.
"I'm afraid we will never find that money."
"Why?"
The banker threw his arms out.
"It has been spread to the wind. I have never seen anything like it in all my years. The initial round of transfers was executed via fax in three waves. They came from all over the world."
"Where?"
"Hong Kong, San Francisco, New York, London, Berlin, Paris, Istanbul, Moscow, New Delhi."
"Moscow?"
"Yes. I would like to see the faxes."
The banker shook his head.
Schwetz sighed. "Oh, why must we do this the hard way? Herr König, I know where the accounts were held, your branch in Geneva. You are not as innocent as you would like me to believe. You will show me those faxes, and if you don't, some people will come visit you in the middle of the night and do to you what was done to Herr Dorfman. Koenig swallowed hard.
I think I can make that concession.
Good. Now, why do you say we will never find the money?
My legal counsel has informed me that not a single bank that we transferred the money to today has consented to our request for information.
Certainly there's a way.
It would involve years of lawsuits, and even then, you would be lucky to track down a fraction of the funds.
Well, maybe you need to turn up the pressure.
Koenig watched as his words seemed to have the opposite effect from the one he'd intended. Koenig stiffened.
I should warn you that a faction of the board feels very strongly that this is dirty money.
Dirty money?
Schwietz asked, as if the accusation were an insult.
There are rumors that Herr Dorfmann was an agent for the East German Stasi before the wall fell.
Rumors are bad things.
And there is another rumor that he worked for your GRU as well. That he helped certain people launder money.
Schwietz gave him a wicked grin. Dorfmann had, in fact, been a spy for the KGB, not the GRU.
Where have you heard such things?
From people who know such things,
Koenig answered cagily. Would you like to talk to them?
Schwietz suddenly got the feeling that he'd lost the upper hand. He needed to say something to fluster Koenig.
Back to these banking laws for a moment. I assume these very same laws could be used to conceal gross incompetence of your branch in Geneva. Or better yet, that one of Herr Dorfmann's colleagues at the bank helped himself to millions of dollars that did not belong to him. Don't they say that most bank heists are inside jobs?
That is pure unfounded speculation.
As is your gossip about Herr Dorfmann being a GRU spy.
Checkmate.
Koenig squirmed for a moment and then offered,
Would you be willing to talk to the people who have sworn that Herr Dorfmann was a spy?
Absolutely, he said, even though he had no such intention. But I would like to see those faxes first, especially the one that originated in Moscow.
Koenig studied him cautiously for a moment and then said, I will have copies of the faxes made for you. Give me a minute. He left the room, glancing back over his shoulder with a frown.
Schwietz paced while he waited. This was starting to look like a big mess. Once these thieves in suits confirmed that Dorfmann had worked for the KGB, they would not be the slightest bit inclined to repay a single dollar. The Germans hated the Russians almost as much as the Russians hated the Germans. Koenig came back a few minutes later. He had two other men with him this time, and Schwietz knew the jig was up. Koenig handed over the stack of faxes. They were blank, except for the sending and receiving fax numbers. The man might as well have written, Fuck you, in large letters across the top sheet. Still, it was better than nothing.
Chapter 41 Zurich, Switzerland. They had drinks in the library, although Rapp thought of it more as shots, like he had done back in college, except instead of a smelly bar in upstate New York, he was in a mansion on the outskirts of one of the most refined cities in the world. Herr Ohlmeyer didn't believe in ruining fine spirits with anything other than ice, so the liquor was served either up, on the rocks, or neat, which Rapp learned was basically naked, meaning nothing but the booze. Rapp chose a glass of 16-year-old Lagavulin single malt scotch, and asked for it on the rocks. Ohlmeyer liked playing host and told Rapp it was a fine choice. Rapp took the glass, smiled, and said, Thank you. Greta had not made her entrance yet, so Rapp took the opportunity to corner Hurley, who was standing by the massive granite fireplace, speaking with one of Ohlmeyer's two sons. He approached Hurley from behind and tapped him on the shoulder. We need to talk. Hurley said something to Ohlmeyer's son in German that Rapp didn't understand, and after he had walked away, Hurley turned to Rapp and asked, What's up? Rapp jerked his head in the direction of the small soundproof office. What was that all about? Hurley's jaw clenched, as was his habit, when he didn't want to talk about something. Reluctantly, he said,
It's part of the deal. Don't worry. Just listen to Carl. He knows what he's doing.
Does Irene know about it? Or Spencer Tracy, that guy who I'm not supposed to know? That was how Rapp referred to the man he had met briefly at the offices of International Software Logistics, the man who, he assumed, was running the show. The question caused the veins on Hurley's neck to bulge, which in turn caused Rapp to take a step back.
That particular physical cue was often a precursor to Hurley's blowing his top. Hurley felt the older Ohlmeyer's eyes on him and told himself to take a deep breath through his nose and exhale through his mouth. It was a trick Lewis had taught him. It helped him center himself. Ohlmeyer despised public outbursts.
"Listen, kid, this is a tough business. There are certain things they don't need to know about and, quite frankly, don't want to know about."
Rapp considered that for a second before asking, "Can it get me in trouble?"
"Pretty much everything we do can get you in trouble with someone. This is about taking care of yourself. No one else needs to know about this other than Carl and his two boys."
Rapp took a sip of his scotch and was about to ask another question but thought better of it. "Don't look a gift horse in the mouth." Hurley wished he could say more, but the kid would have to figure it out the hard way, as he himself had had to do back in the day. He took a big gulp of bourbon and thought about how much easier it would have been if someone had just pointed a few things out to him. Hurley changed his mind and decided to let it fly.
"Kid, you're good, and that's no small thing coming from me. My job is to find faults and try to beat them out of you. At some point in this line of work, I don't care how good you are, I don't care how just your cause, sooner or later you're going to land yourself in a big pile of shit. It might be your fault, although more than likely it'll be some asshole back stateside out to make a name for himself so he can advance his career. He'll put a target on your back. And trust me on this one. Even though you're going to want to stand and fight, you need to run. Run and hide. Lie low. Wait for things to blow over."
"And then what?"
"You live to fight another day. Or maybe you just disappear for good."
Rapp frowned, and Hurley knew exactly what he was thinking.
"We're not that different, kid. The idea of running away for good isn't in our veins, but it's nice to have options. You bide your time, you find out who it is who's out to get you, and then you go after them."
Rapp absorbed the advice and looked around the courtly library. "When are we shipping out?"
"Tomorrow morning. I was going to tell you guys later."
"Where to?"
"Back to the scene of the crime.
Beirut?"
Rapp whispered.
"Yep." Hurley held up his glass.
"Although I might have a small job for you first."
"What kind of job?"
"We might have a lead on someone."
"Who?"
"I don't want to say yet."
"Come on."
"Nope. No sense in getting your hopes up. Irene is flying over in the morning to brief us. If she's verified it, I will send you on a quick one-day detour, and then you can join up with us in Beirut."
"And the intel on Beirut?"
"It's good. Really good. These guys have been singing like birds all day."
The men spent another 30 minutes in the library. Ohlmeyer took the time to introduce both of his sons to Rapp and Richards. The older one was Auguste, and the younger was Robert, and both were vice presidents at the bank and held positions on the board. The patriarch of the family assured the two young men that they could trust his sons, and Hurley seconded the opinion. Ohlmeyer knew that they would be leaving in the morning and suggested that they reconvene at the earliest possible time to work out the protocols and to make sure that each man understood the details of his various legends. Chapter 42. Shortly before 7, they moved from the library to a sitting room that was decorated in the French Baroque style. The white carved flowers, leaves, and shells on the furniture and molding were in stark contrast to the deep, natural woods of the library. Sitting on one of the room's four sofas was Greta. Next to her was an older woman whom Rapp took to be her grandmother, and thus Carl Ohlmeyer's wife. Greta smiled at him from across the room. Rapp, in control of his faculties this time, flashed her a crooked grin and walked over, shaking his head. "Good evening, ladies." Rapp offered his hand again. This time it was dry. "Greta, you look lovely."
"Thank you, Mitch. I mean, Mike."
Rapp laughed. "You're good."
"I'd like you to meet my grandmother, Elsa."
Rapp offered his hand. "Very nice to meet you, Frau Ohlmeyer. You have a lovely home." Rapp thought he noticed something wrong with her eyes when she smiled. A certain disconnect. Her grip was also a bit weak, and he wondered if she might be ill. Herr Ohlmeyer was suddenly at Rapp's side.
"Michael, I see you. I've met Greta."
"Yes, we bumped into each other this afternoon."
"And my wife?"
Ohlmeyer placed a hand on her shoulder. "Yes." Looking back at his granddaughter, he said,
Greta is our pride and joy.
I can see why. She's very sharp.
Yes, and so far, the only one of my grandchildren who has shown any interest in getting into the banking business. For the next 5 minutes, Rapp got the family history. Carl and Elsa had 2 boys and 2 girls. One daughter was married and lived in London, and the other was divorced and in Spain. Auguste and Robert's wives were currently on vacation with their sister-in-law at her Spanish villa. There were 11 grandchildren, of which Greta was the 3rd eldest. Elsa did not speak, although she did smile a few times. Richards, Hurley, and the 2 brothers were at the opposite end of the room, no doubt discussing matters of far greater importance, but Rapp didn't beat up on himself too badly. Standing this close to Greta was worth it. Every chance Rapp got, he stole a look. Her high ponytail had been changed out for a loose clip in the back that made her look much more mature than when he'd met her earlier in the day. She was wearing a cobalt blue silk blouse and a black skirt with gray tights. He thought Herr Ohlmeyer caught him at least once ogling her, and he had no idea what Elsa was thinking. She just kept smiling at him with that faraway look in her eyes. The Ohlmeyers were kind enough not to ask him any personal questions about his own family, as he would have been forced to tell them a lie. Herr Ohlmeyer decided it was time to sit for dinner. He asked for his wife's hand, but before she stood, she pulled her granddaughter close and whispered something in her ear. Greta giggled, while her grandmother pulled away and flashed Rapp an intriguing smile before pulling her granddaughter close again. She whispered another few lines before finally taking her husband's hand and standing. Elsa took a step toward Rapp, and to his surprise, she reached out and gently patted him on the cheek. She gave him a warm smile and then walked away without saying a word. Rapp turned to Greta. "You have a very interesting grandmother." Greta reached out and grabbed his arm, pulling him close and walking him toward the dining room, but in no rush to catch up with the others. "Granny Elsa is an amazing woman. Unfortunately, she is not well." "What's wrong?" Rapp said, as his stomach did flips over Greta's touch. "She has Alzheimer's." "I'm sorry." "No need to be sorry. These things happen. Such is life." "I suppose," Rapp said, turning toward her. She smelled so good, he wanted to bury his face in her mane of shiny blonde hair. "She has no regrets. She led a very active life up until just 1 year ago. I'm living here now and working at the bank. This way I can spend time with her while she still remembers me."
"That's nice."
"We spend our evenings going through letters and photos. There is so much family history that only she knows. My grandfather is a brilliant man, but he has a hard time remembering the names of his own grandchildren."
"Not yours. You can tell he thinks the world of you."
"Well, I work for him. I would hope he remembers my name." As they entered the dining room, Rapp said, "Do you mind me asking what your grandmother whispered in your ear?" Greta gave him a nervous laugh and rested her head against his shoulder before releasing his arm. "Maybe after a few drinks." Rapp followed her like a puppy dog down the right side of the long table. There were chairs for 20, but they were only 8, so they clustered at the far end, with Carl at the head of the table and Elsa to his left, followed by Greta and Rapp. Hurley was to Carl's right, followed by Auguste, then Richards, and finally Robert. The wine glasses were filled, and conversations that had been going continued while new ones were started. Richards got Rapp's attention at one point and gave him a you-lucky-bastard shake of his head while darting his eyes at Greta. Rapp, for his part, struck up a rather boring conversation with Greta's uncle, who was sitting directly across from him. When Greta had finished her glass of wine, Rapp leaned over and asked, "So, can you tell me now?" Greta slid her hand over and patted his thigh. "One more glass, I think." She held up her glass, and one of the servants filled it. "So how does an all-American boy such as yourself end up in this nasty line of work?"
"We get recruited, like any other profession."
"So your background is military?"
Rapp shook his head and smiled. "I'm a fine arts major with a minor in poetry."
Greta's face lit up in surprise for a moment, and then she caught herself. "You are teasing me."
"Yes, I am."
"Why?" she asked playfully.
"Because you know I can't talk about my past, and I tend to tease people whom I like." "So, you like me?" she said, with an approving nod.
He didn't know why he decided to say it. Maybe it was the wine, maybe it was his newfound confidence that he was finally making a difference, that he was part of something important. But he did nonetheless. Rapp leaned in close, so only she could hear, and said, "I don't know what it is about you, but I've had a hard time thinking of anything but you since we met this afternoon." She smiled at him, her cheeks flushing just a touch.
"You are different, not so guarded."
Rapp laughed. "I'm probably the most guarded person you'll ever meet. Just not with you, for some reason."
"Is that good or bad?"
"I think it's good. At least, it feels good." Rapp looked into her blue eyes. She was smiling back at him. He was about to really open up when Herr Ohlmeyer tapped his wine glass with his knife several times and stood. Ohlmeyer raised his glass and started giving a toast. Rapp turned his chair slightly so he could face him, and his right knee moved to within a few inches of Greta's thigh. Then her left hand slowly slid over from her lap and found his knee. From that moment on, Rapp didn't register a single word that came out of Herr Ohlmeyer's mouth, nor did he hear anything Hurley said when he rose to make his toast. The main course arrived. It was a braised beef of some sort, served with mushrooms, potatoes, gravy, and vegetables, the kind of meat and potatoes meal Rapp loved. There was only one problem. He had just stuffed a forkful of beef in his mouth when Greta leaned over and told him what her grandmother had whispered in her ear. "My granny thinks you are extremely attractive. She told me I should sleep with you." Rapp would have been fine if it had ended there, but it didn't. As he tried to swallow the meat, Greta leaned over once more.
"She said that if I don't, she will."
Rapp froze, his eyes bulged, and a piece of meat got stuck in the crossroads of his throat. His brain's autopilot kicked in, and the hunk of meat came flying back up as fast as a major league fastball. The only thing that saved it from pelting Richards in the face was Rapp's quick hands, a fit that started out as a cough morphed into eye-watering laughter. Greta smacked him on the back a few times and had to hold her napkin over her mouth to conceal her own laughter and amusement that she had set the chain of events in motion. Conversation ceased, and all eyes settled on the young duo. Greta saved them by announcing,
"I'm sorry." She dabbed at her eyes. "I told him a bad joke."
Rapp finally got hold of himself, and everyone went back to their conversations. Rapp noticed Hurley giving him a few cautious looks, but other than that, no one appeared to notice the flirting. Shortly after dessert was served, Elsa tapped Greta on the arm and told her she was tired. Everyone stood while the two women made their exit, and then Ohlmeyer suggested they retire to the library. Hurley disappeared into the small soundproof office, and it was Rapp's turn to talk with the two uncles. They gave Rapp a message service to call if he needed to contact them. He was never to call the office directly, especially if he was in trouble. Rapp kept looking over his shoulder, hoping to see Greta, but she didn't return. About an hour into it, the brothers thought they had made enough progress and agreed they would sit down again when Rapp came through town again in the coming weeks. It was just before 10 when the two brothers left. Rapp thanked Herr Ohlmeyer for an interesting evening and headed upstairs with one thing on his mind. Greta. He stood in the long hallway outside his room for a moment, loitering, hoping she would suddenly appear. He had no idea where her room was, but suspected that the guests were in this wing and the family's rooms were in the other wing of the house. After another 15 seconds of standing there feeling stupid, he gave up and opened his door. Rapp peeled off his suit coat and tie, draping both over the back of the desk chair. With the water running, he started brushing his teeth and unbuttoning his white dress shirt. He walked back into the bedroom and was dropping the dress shirt on top of the tie and coat when he thought he heard a sound at the door. He froze, hoping it was Greta. A few seconds later, he heard the footsteps of someone walking away. He walked to the door and listened for a few seconds before checking the hallway. It was empty. Rapp closed the door and stood there resting his head against the door. After nearly a minute, he decided he was acting like a fool. He twisted the lock from midnight to 3 and climbed into the big bed, wishing Greta was next to him. He yawned
and rubbed his eyes. He was tired, after all. Rolling over, he extinguished the bedside lamp and thought about tomorrow. The side trip that Hurley had alluded to had his interest. He wondered who the target was and if he'd had a direct role in the Pan Am attack. The happy thoughts of ending that type of man's life sent him drifting off toward sleep, and then, suddenly, there was a faint knock on the door. Rapp threw back the blankets and rushed to the door. The knocking grew a bit louder. Rapp twisted the lock and opened the door a crack. The sight of Greta's blonde hair put an instant smile on his face. She pushed through, not wanting to be discovered in the hall, closing the door behind her and locking it. Rapp opened his mouth to speak, but she put a finger on his lips and a hand on his chest. She pushed him back toward the bed, and then, rising to her toes, she kissed him on the mouth. Rapp responded with a soft gasp and pulled her close, wrapping an arm around her waist. Hands started to roam, and the kissing became intense, and then Rapp pulled her head back and rested his forehead against hers. He looked into her eyes, but before he could speak, she gave him a wicked smile and pushed him back onto the bed. Rapp watched as Greta undid her robe, letting it fall to the floor. She was naked. He reached out for her, and she slowly climbed onto the bed. He pulled her close, kissing her neck and running a hand down her perfect, smooth, naked backside. A low rumble of approval passed his lips as he nibbled on her ear and then other parts. Holding her tight, he took control and rolled over. Rapp held her exquisite face in his hands and looked into her eyes. At that moment, there was nothing beyond the here and now. There was no yesterday or tomorrow. He hadn't felt this alive in years. Chapter 43. Beirut, Lebanon. They were to meet 2 hours after sunrise. Syed asked Mugnia why 2 hours, and he told him it was because the cowardly Americans only attacked with the cover of darkness and the Jewish dogs with the rising sun at their backs. Syed had seen the Jews attack at all hours of the day, but he wasn't going to argue with Mugnia, at least not considering his current mood. Syed looked down at his little CIA guinea pig. The man was not doing well. None of the nails had grown back enough to use the pliers, so he'd been forced to drill a hole through one of the agent's nail beds to try to get him to respond to his questions. Instead, the man had passed out. There were parameters in these situations, but they were only parameters. You could never tell when you had an outlier. On that note, Syed still wasn't sure about Cummins. Given the less-than-sanitary conditions, it was entirely possible that he was seriously ill. Aziz Al-Aboub had taught him how a subject could become sick to the point of the nervous system shutting down. Once that happened, the only thing you could do was nurse the subject back to health, and then start over. Unfortunately, Mugnia and the others wanted answers that were simply not here. At least, not in Cummins's head. They were distrustful of Ivanov and his constant plotting, but there was still a deep-seated hatred of the Americans and Jews, and they wanted to know if this man knew anything about their missing money. Beyond that, there was a fundamental problem that they had overlooked, which was not unusual for the collective group. They were far too one-dimensional and always looked at a situation as if it were a street battle in Beirut. Attack, retreat, dig, and fight. This was the extent of their military repertoire. In the espionage business, Syed had to analyze in three dimensions and project possible outcomes. This John Cummins was going to eventually end up in the hands of Ivanov, if for no other reason than that Ivanov was used to getting his way. Syed had to be very careful what type of questions he asked, with an eye to the fact that the subject would eventually inform Ivanov of what he'd been asked. Syed would have to start the subject on a cycle of antibiotics. The others could talk all they wanted about not handing Cummins over, but Syed was done with him. There was nothing more to learn, and he did not wish to be put in the middle of this fight. He wiped the small splotch of blood on the front of the white butcher's apron and wondered what he should tell Damascus. They would want to be fully briefed on the situation, but they did not have to deal with all these crazy Palestinians. That was the paradox of Lebanon in general and Beirut specifically. The Palestinians were supposed to be in Palestine, not Lebanon. The Palestinians had upset the balance that the Turks had kept for centuries. Their displacement by the Jews shattered the fragile peace and plunged the country into civil war. And now, more than 15 years later, that civil war was over and the Palestinians were growing cocksure. With relative peace, Damascus was losing its sway over how all these vying factions conducted themselves. Damascus, for its part, was slow to realize what was plain to see. The child was now an adult, and did not appreciate, much less need, the consent of the parent. Fortunately for Syed, he was more like an uncle, a very non-judgmental uncle, especially this morning. Syed knocked on the metal door and waited for it to be opened by the guard. He stepped into the hallway and closed the door behind him. Looking at the two guards, he said, "He will need medical attention. Pass the word to the others. I want him treated like a baby. No more kicking or punching." The two men nodded, and Syed moved off down the hallway, still struggling with what he should tell Damascus. He could hardly share the details of the past few days. The Swiss accounts that had been so carefully set up were now empty. Damascus had contributed zero to the accounts, but they were aware of their existence. They didn't know, however, that Syed had set up an account for himself with the aid of Sharif and Ivanov. He took a cut of every arms shipment that came into the country by helping assure that the various Syrian factions would leave the merchants be. Damascus needed to be kept in the dark as long as possible. He stopped in the small sandbagged lobby on the first floor. The door was completely blocked, and the floor-to-ceiling windows on each side were now nothing but small portholes, just enough to allow a man to take up a rifle position. Oh, how he wished those pesky Maronites would go away! He climbed to the second story and followed the extension cords and phone lines to the makeshift command post. Once again, the hallway was filled with armed men, but this time they didn't upset Syed. He needed them to deter the Christians from doing anything stupid. They were living in abject squalor. There was no running water, electricity, or phone service. The men were relieving themselves in the basement in random rooms and corners. No wonder Cummins was sick. Electricity and phone service would have to be brought in from 3 blocks away via a series of patched cords and lines that had been spliced into the service of an apartment building. The guard stepped aside so he could pass, and he entered the command post. The men were standing around a sheet of plywood that had been placed on top of 2 50-gallon oil drums. Mugniyah and Badruddin from Islamic Jihad, Jalil, who was Syed's Iranian counterpart, and Radi from Fatah. Each man had benefited handsomely from his association with the Turkish arms dealer, and now they were once again paupers. "Close the door," Mugniyah commanded. Syed did so and joined the men at the makeshift table. "Well?" Mugniyah asked. "Nothing." "Nothing?" Radi asked, obviously dubious. Syed looked at the little toad from Fatah and said, "I have been informed that some of your men have taken certain liberties with my prisoner over the past few days."
"Your prisoner?" Radi shouted. "He is my prisoner."
"The prisoner," Syed said, "has been kicked and brutalized by your men, and due to the lack of sanitary conditions from your men defecating all over the basement like a pack of wild dogs, it appears the prisoner is now ill." Badruddin made a foul face and said,
"Really?
You should institute some basic hygiene, at least have the men go on the roof. The sun will take care of it for you."
"Do you want to walk up 7 flights of stairs to go to the bathroom?" Radi asked.
"Enough," yelled an impatient Mugniyah. He looked from one end of the table to the other, making it clear to all that he was not in the mood for petty arguments. "Someone has stolen millions of dollars from us, and you want to argue about where the men should shit?"
"I was only—"
"Silence!" Mugniyah screeched. With his fists clenched, he turned on Radi.
"I am sick of it. All of the complaining and fighting, the bickering, and for what? It gets us nowhere. Millions are gone. Sharif is dead. Our banker is dead. And that vulture, Ivanov, is now talking about coming to Beirut for the first time in years. Am I the only one who finds this a bit disconcerting?"
"He told me he had nothing to do with Sharif's murder," Syed offered.
"And since when do you believe anything that comes out of a Russian's mouth?"
"I have no trust in the man, but on this point he did seem to be upset that someone had killed Sharif."
"Maybe someone else did kill Sharif. And that was when Ivanov decided that with our Turkish friend gone, it was the perfect time to take all of the money."
Syed considered that one for a moment,
It was possible.
Ivanov had proven many times that he could be ruthless.
Add to that these damn Christians deciding to make a show of strength.
Mugnia gave a swift shake of his head.
I like none of it. Something is very wrong, and we know far too little.
Why would Ivanov want to visit Beirut?
Badreddin asked.
Land.
All eyes fell on Colonel Jalil of the Iranian Quds Force.
Explain,
Mugnia ordered.
There is a great deal of valuable land here in Beirut, and many are saying that with war finally behind us, there are huge sums of money to be made.
Why can't these people leave us alone?
Mugnia asked no one in particular.
What about the Americans?
Radi asked.
We have one of their agents in this very building.
Who was sent here to negotiate the release of the businessman you kidnapped? Syed's tone suggested what he thought of the idea.
That is the story he has given you.
Syed turned his head to look at Radi.
You doubt my ability to get the truth out of people? None of us are perfect.
So you think the American is holding back on us? That his coming here is all part of a master plan by the Americans to take over Beirut?
I did not say that.
You did, in so many words. Looking back toward the leaders of Islamic Jihad, he said, We do not have enough information to know what is actually happening. It could be anyone at this point, but based on what we do know, we have to assume that Ivanov is the front-runner.
So what should we do?
Badreddin asked. Syed thought about it for a moment and then said, Let him come to Beirut. Keep our eyes and ears open and see what we can find out. Mugnia was scratching his beard, thinking about what had been said.
Beirut is our fortress. Spread the word to our people at the docks and the airport. I want to know of anything that looks suspicious. Americans, Russians, Jews, I don't care.
And we should alert our allies, the Iranian said. Everyone should be extra careful until we know exactly what is going on.
I agree, Mugnia said. Quietly spread the word to our people in Europe. Especially anyone who has a connection to Sharif. Let them know of our concerns. That someone might be targeting us.
It was the right decision. But Syed needed to add something. No mention of the money, though. At least not yet. One by one they all nodded, as he knew they would. To a man they were too proud to admit that they had been duped out of such a large sum of money. Chapter 44, Zurich, Switzerland. The Gulfstream 450 landed at Zurich International Airport and proceeded to the fueling pad rather than customs. The flight plan stated that the plane was stopping for fuel before continuing to Kuwait. The truck was waiting, and while one of the men began to unwind the hose, a second man in blue coveralls approached the plane's fuselage, opened his hand, and slapped the side of the plane three times. A second later, the hatch opened and the stairs lowered. The man bounded up the steps and hit the button to pull the stairs back up and close the hatch. He checked to make sure the cockpit door was closed and proceeded into the cabin. Hurley took off the baseball cap and sat in one of the two open chairs across from Irene Kennedy. They were separated by a table.
Good morning.
Hurley tapped the thick file that was sitting in front of the young counterterrorism analyst.
I assume that's for me.
Kennedy pulled the file closer to herself and said, Before we get to this, there are a few things we need to discuss.
Well, let's make it quick because I have a schedule to keep, and we need to get you back up in the air before customs comes poking around.
She nodded as if to say fine and then asked, What was the final dollar amount?
For?
You know damn well what for.
Oh, the thing.
Hurley looked around the cabin as if he was trying to add it all up in his head.
I suppose somewhere in the neighborhood of...
Hurley flashed her a four with one hand and a five with the other.
Roughly, of course. A lot of it gets siphoned off along the way, fees and whatnot.
You're sure? Kennedy asked, fairly confident that he was lying to her.
Irene, to be frank, it's really none of your business. This is between Tom and me.
Well, Thomas wanted me to ask you face to face, since you're so paranoid about using phones.
He knows damn well why I don't use phones. The same reason he doesn't.
True, but he still wants to know.
Why?
Hurley asked. Because he thinks you're holding back on him. Hurley laughed.
Stansfield knew damn well Hurley would never give him an official accounting. To handle all the black bag stuff they threw his way, he had to have access to piles of cash.
"Darling niece, I think you are either bending the truth or trying to bluff me. Which one is it?"
Kennedy studied him with a crooked frown, none too happy that he had figured out what she was up to. "A little of both, I suppose."
"And why are you trying to stick your pretty little nose where it doesn't belong?"
"Because someday, not too soon, I hope, you and Thomas are going to die, and somebody will need to make sense of the tangled web you've left behind."
"If anything happens to me in the next few days, tell Thomas I said to visit our old friend from Berlin, who now lives in Zurich. He'll have the answers you need."
Her bluff called. Kennedy grabbed a file sitting in the seat next to her. Unlike the bland manila one on the table, this one was gray. Kennedy placed it in front of Hurley and opened it to reveal a black-and-white photograph of a man exiting a car on an unknown city street. "Look familiar?" Hurley glanced at the photo and lied.
"Not really."
"This is Nikolai Schwitz. Name ring a bell?"
"A soft bell. I have a lot of Russian names floating around in my head. It's hard to keep them all straight. Kind of like reading War and Peace."
"Sure," Kennedy replied, not buying a word of it. "Care to guess where this photo was taken?"
Hurley glanced at his watch. "We don't have time to play 20 questions, young lady, so let's get on with it."
"Hamburg. A certain bank that drew a lot of interest yesterday. Any idea why one of Mikhail Ivanov's top deputies would show up yesterday, of all days?" Hurley shook his head. "He threatened the bank's president about some missing funds." Kennedy searched his face for some recognition. "And if your answer is still no, I won't bother playing you the tape of your old friend Ivanov talking to a certain terrorist that we've been looking for." Hurley frowned. He didn't like being forced to answer this kind of question by someone so junior. "Thomas told me," Kennedy said, "that you would be reluctant to talk about this, but nonetheless, I have been ordered to get an answer from you."
"What kind of answer?"
"How many people did you piss off yesterday, other than the ones we know about?"
"It was a thick file," Hurley shrugged. "Some accounts had names attached to them, others were just numbers."
"So your earlier estimate might be a little light?"
"Get to your point.
It looks like you've pissed off some people in Moscow. And you know how they can be when they're upset. They don't play nice. If they get so much as an inkling that we were behind any of this..." She shook her head. "We'll be in serious trouble."
"So you want me to confirm what you don't want to hear?"
"I just want to know the facts, so I can go back and brief Thomas. He needs to tell our embassy people if they are in danger of reprisals and anyone else who might get stuck in Ivanov's crosshairs." Hurley swore under his breath and finally said,
"Yes, I took some of the bastard's money, and with any luck, it'll be the beginning of the end of him."
Kennedy took the news without comment and placed a small tape player between them. "Now, you will be very interested to hear this brief conversation." Kennedy pressed play, and the slurred voice of Mikhail Ivanov could be heard asking,
"My package, is it ready? You haven't decided to negotiate with the Persians, have you?"
"I'm standing by our deal." Kennedy pressed the stop button. "You recognize the first voice?"
Hurley nodded. "Ivanov."
"Correct. The second voice?"
"No."
"Colonel Asif Syed." Hurley was impressed.
"What the hell are they doing talking on an open line?"
"They weren't. But you didn't hear that from me."
"Then how'd you get it?"
"I can't say." Kennedy pressed play again.
"When can I expect it to be retrieved? I assume you are still sending someone."
"Yes, although I am considering coming myself. You did offer, didn't you?"
"Absolutely."
"Good. I will be there in 3 days, maybe sooner."
Kennedy hit stop. "There's more. Tapes of Ivanov and Syed and others as well. You'll want to listen to all of them, but Thomas does not want you bringing the tapes into Beirut."
"Understood. Did you happen to pick up Badruddin or Mugnia?"
"Unfortunately, no, but we have a few others that I think will please you."
Kennedy retrieved another folder from her briefcase and laid it before Hurley. Tariq Al-Ismail.
Music to my fucking ears. Please tell me you ID'd the prick.
Hiding right under our noses a few kilometers down the road.
Where?
He's been working at the UN office in Geneva, attached to the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, if you can believe it. He lost a few pounds, cut his hair and beard, and ditched his contacts for eyeglasses. You have to admire his tradecraft. Kennedy fingered the old photo from his days when he was running operations for the Libyan Intelligence Service, and then the new photo. It's a pretty good effort.
You sure, Tim?
90% on the photo and 99.9% on the voice ID. And he was calling about money missing from his account. If we hadn't had the big ears focused on these banks, I don't think we would have ever caught him. Hurley thought of their conversation last night and frowned.
So, you want to send Rap after him?
Not just me. Ismail is near the top of Thomas's list.
I don't know, Irene,
Hurley said with obvious reluctance.
Ismail could bite back. He's not some fat arms dealer, he's a real killer.
In a perfect world, Thomas would send all three of you after him, but we don't have that luxury right now.
Why? Let's put Beirut off for a few days.
Like a Vegas dealer, Kennedy slid the gray file off to the side and moved the manila file front and center. In the transcript, you heard Ivanov ask if his package was ready?
Yeah.
He asked Syed if he was going to negotiate with the Persians instead?
Yeah.
Remember what they did to Buckley?
Remember? I think about it all the time. I was just telling Mitch and Bobby Richards about him.
Well, Thomas thinks the schnoz is the package they are referring to. Everything stopped. Hurley didn't so much as twitch for a good 10 seconds. He'd known the schnoz for close to 20 years, and there was a running shopping list in his head of all the operations he'd been involved in. After a quick assessment of the potential damage, he leaned back and dropped the F-bomb. Cummins had worked in Moscow before Damascus. If the Russians got their hands on him, they would be screwed in some of their most sensitive operations. He shook his head to get over the shock and said,
"We can't let that happen."
Thomas agrees. He has a source that says schnoz is still alive, emaciated and battered, but still alive.
Shit.
That's why he wants you and Richards to get to Beirut ASAP. As we discussed last night, Rapp will join up with you tomorrow or the next day. In the meantime, you two start poking around. If you can't find anything in 48 hours, Thomas wants you to use some of the new funds to negotiate for the schnoz's release, very quietly, though.
Of course.
Hurley was still trying to calculate the damage.
What about backup?
He's agreed to send a SOG team, but doesn't want to put them in country until you have something solid.
Understood.
SOG stood for Special Operations Group. There was a good chance Hurley would know the men.
Air cover?
If you need it, he'll get it. Last resort, though. Before Hurley could comment, there was a banging on the side of the plane, and he realized it was time to go. Kennedy passed him two files. Those are for you. This one, she said as she handed him a third, is for Mitch. Make sure he knows to destroy it before he makes contact with Ismail.
Will do,
Hurley stood.
Anything else?
Kennedy joined him in the aisle. She didn't want him to go, but he was a good soldier, so there was no stopping him. So much of their shared sorrow revolved around that once beautiful city on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. Hurley could see that she was concerned, and he knew why. He gave her a hug and said,
"Don't worry. Everything will be fine."
"Yeah," she said, not really believing it herself, and holding back the tears. Beirut's still a nasty place. She stayed strong for him. There was no turning back now that he knew. The only thing to do was support him. She kissed him on the cheek and said, "Be careful." Chapter 45. Geneva, Switzerland. When it was all done, Rapp would swear that he felt the zip of the bullet as it passed his left temple. It was that close. The only thing that saved him was the awkward movement that the Libyan made as he drew his pistol. The fake was weak. He looked over his left shoulder a bit too dramatically and then
swung back to his right, drawing his gun, his long overcoat flaring like a matador's cape. The other reason Rapp didn't fall for it was that mean old cuss Stan Hurley. It was the first time Rapp could honestly say he was grateful for all the shit Hurley had heaped on him. All of that damn methodical, shitty training paid off in the split second it took Ismail to draw his gun and turn on him. The fact that Rapp didn't want to kill the wrong man also contributed to the harsh reality that he was now cowering behind a Swiss mailbox, rounds of an undetermined caliber thudding into the metal receptacle at an alarming rate. And Hurley had been right, of course. He had told them that there were two ways to win a gunfight. Either land the first shot, or find cover and conserve your ammunition. Hurley had put them in a situation so similar to this that it was now damn near calming to listen to his opponent mindlessly fire one shot after the next into a four-sided box of steel that had survived every change of season for the past 50 years. Back in the woods of Virginia, the idea was to find cover while Hurley fired live shots at you. And mind you, he didn't fire them safely over the horizon. He liked to hit things close to you. Not rocks or anything, hard enough to cause a life-ending ricochet, but soft things like dirt, sandbags, and wood. The object of the lesson was to teach you what it felt like to be shot at so you could keep your head when confronted with the real thing. As a bonus, you learned to count not just the number of rounds you fired, but the number of rounds your opponent fired as well. At first, the exercise was unnerving, but after a while, as with most things in life, you adapted and got the hang of it. Rapp squatted, his back pressed firmly against the mailbox, and counted the number of shots, which had been 8 so far. He was waiting for the inevitable calm in the storm. There was a problem, however. While Rapp's pistols were equipped with silencers, the Libyan's gun was not. 8 extremely loud gunshots had rung out in a city with one of the lowest murder rates in the entire industrialized world. It might as well have been an artillery barrage. There was no telling how many extra magazines the Libyan had in his possession, but he doubted the man could match the 72 rounds Rapp carried. Rapp released the grip of his still-holstered Beretta and stabbed the big gray button on his Timex digital watch. Just as Hurley had taught him, it was set for stopwatch mode. The average response time for a police car in a city of this size was roughly 3 minutes, and that was assuming there wasn't one nearby. There were rules that were flexible, and there were rules that couldn't be broken. And killing a police officer was one of those unbreakable rules. Hurley had told them, "If you kill a cop, I will kill you before they do." The first 8 shots had come in rapid succession. By the sound, they were 9mm or maybe .40 caliber at the most. Rapp never heard where the first one landed after it flew past his head. But the second shot had blown out the driver's side window of the white BMW parked a few feet away, which was now chirping and beeping like a car with Tourette syndrome. The next 6 had hit the mailbox. Not a smart move, unless he had a second gun and he was closing on him. Rapp thought that unlikely. Ismail was spooked and on the run, which in itself bothered Rapp. The drive from Zurich had been easy, just under 3 hours, counting a quick stop to call the answering service and confirm that the target was at his place of work. The file was straightforward. They were monitoring the calls he made at work. They knew where he lived and the make and model of his car. Hurley gave Rapp specific instructions: tail Ismail after work and follow him to his apartment. If he comes out for an errand or an evening stroll and there's an opportunity, take him. If not, wait until morning and shoot him while he's getting into his car. Rapp had followed the instructions to the letter, and when Ismail bowed out of his apartment at 10:09 that evening, Rapp watched him round the corner and then pursued on foot. A block later, Rapp noticed that Ismail had a duffel bag slung over his left shoulder. It was at that point that the wheels started to turn in Rapp's head. He asked himself if it was normal to leave your apartment on a crisp winter night when you should be getting into bed. It wasn't unheard of for someone to head out after 10, but it was far from common, especially on a Tuesday night. Throw in the overnight bag and you now had someone who might be running. That was pretty much what Rapp was thinking when Ismail pulled his lame matador move. That, and wondering if he could rush him at the next intersection, shoot him in the back of the head, and be in France before midnight. Now, because he had failed to heed Hurley's warnings, he was crouched behind a mailbox, counting bullets and wondering if Ismail had 1 or 2 guns. One more shot thudded into the mailbox, and then there was a 2-second pause. Rapp stuck out his gloved hand to see if he could draw a shot. He pulled it back as a tenth bullet whistled harmlessly past. It sparked off the stone sidewalk and skipped down the street.